difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it's shaped our thoughts on a new release. I'm Scott Tobias, here this week with Tasha Robinson, Rachel Handler, Keith Phipps, and behind the scenes, producer Genevieve Kosky. We're all firm believers in the idea that no film exists in a vacuum, and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and how it relates to a current release. Tasha, tell us about this week's movie pairing.
Just a year after winning the Best Picture Oscar for Birdman, director Alejandro González Iñárritu is back with The Revenant, a half-revenge thriller, half-survival adventure set in the frosty American wilderness. The Revenant was photographed in remote mountain areas in Canada and Argentina using entirely natural light, and it was by all accounts a difficult production. But Iñárritu's commitment to shooting in extreme conditions is key to the film's visceral punch. It also recalls the work of cinema's most intrepid adventurer, Werner Herzog, particularly Aguirre, The Wrath of God, his 1972 cult classic about Spanish conquistadors in South America searching for El Dorado, the lost city of gold. Among other things, both The Revenant and Aguirre are about the arrogance of non-natives trying to exploit a foreign land, and both center on men who are pushed to the brink of madness and beyond. Scott, break down this week's discussion for us.
Well, Tasha, in the first half, we'll focus on Aguirre, the Wrath of God, and the many elements that carry over into Iñárritu's film, from its harsh natural setting to its native and non-native characters to the crazed, ambitious men who serve as its driving force. In the second half, dropping later this week, we'll bring The Revenant into the conversation in our forum discussion, talking about how Aguirre and The Revenant each deal with issues like madness and masculinity and what sets them apart. And as always, we'll wrap things up with your Next Picture Show, where we discuss some of our recent film-related experiences that should be on your radar. So let's all get our immunizations in order and follow these lunatics into the wild. Werner Herzog has spent a four-decade-plus career going back and forth between documentary films and features, always driven by an immense curiosity about the relationship between human beings and the natural world. He recently coined the phrase ecstatic truth to defend nonfiction films accused of not abiding impossible journalistic standards. But really, the line between Herzog's documentaries and features has always been a little blurry. In every film, he's trying to immerse himself in environments that interest him, and his fiction features each have the unmistakable imprint of their production. It may not have been necessary for Herzog to drag a 320-ton steamboat up a hill for Fitzcarraldo, but the effort shows on screen. For Aguirre, The Wrath of God, Herzog and his crew spent 5 weeks in the Amazon rainforest and trudged through the vines and across the river in a manner similar to the 16th-century adventurers on the hunt for El Dorado. Leading the charge is Herzog's chief collaborator and best fiend, Klaus Kinski, who stars as Aguirre, a treacherous man who starts as second in command on the expedition, but eventually takes over through mutiny and death. As the mission grows more desperate, with heavily armored men falling to illness, starvation, and the arrows of native tribes, Kinski's tyrannical Aguirre presses on to the bitter end. The theme of man against nature has been a primary obsession of Herzog's throughout his career, and Aguirre, the Wrath of God has long been a key example. There have been times when he's extended sympathy toward mad visionaries like Fitzcarraldo and Fitzcarraldo, or Timothy Treadwell and Grizzly Man, but with Aguirre, Herzog exposes the arrogance of white Europeans who believe the world easily conquered. In order to make one's way through nature, Herzog implies, you have to show some humility, and the image of armored conquistadors trudging through the Amazon shows anything but.
Our land is already 6 times larger than Spain. And every day we drift makes it bigger.
Have you seen any solid ground recently to support your weight?
So, gang, maybe the best place to start is a question I even have written down here. I want to know just generally what everyone thought of the film Aguirre, the Wrath of God. Tasha, let's start with you.
This is my second favorite Herzog after Grizzly Man. In a walk, I mean, he's made so many fantastic films, but this was the one I remember so clearly the first time I saw it. And it was after I had seen Fitzcarraldo and, you know, Burden of Dreams, which he didn't shoot, but, you know, which is key to understanding him. Mm-hmm. And probably Encounters at the End of the World. And I think I basically just went on a giant tear after Grizzly Man. And then I got to this one and it just stopped me dead. It has one of the most, like that, the final sequence on the raft, which I won't spoil, mm-hmm. is for me one of the most memorable cinematic images of all time. I love this film for many, many reasons, which we'll get into.
Yeah, I'll pick up where Tasha left off. I think it's bookended by just two of the most striking shots of Herzog's career, that ending sequence and that opening sequence, which we can talk about pretty openly, of the party that just seems to stretch off into infinity, descending through the hills and up the hills. And it's like they look so out of place. Like these European conquistadors, if that's even the right word, are in a place that's not. They're not meant to be. And it's just like the alienation from the natural world is there right from the beginning. And it goes, things start going wrong in the first scene where the cannon falls and it just blows up and takes trees with it. It's just, okay, here's the movie in a few seconds, you know?
And what about you, Rachel?
For me, I first saw this in college, and I sort of, after seeing The Revenant, I liked it even more because I really just didn't like The Revenant. And that's sort of, all the problems with The Revenant are not present in this movie. And I also forgot almost how funny it was. I mean, I know we'll talk about this a little later, but I don't know if that I caught that when I was 18 and I mm-hmm. watched this. I laughed so much, and I just thought, you know, I mean, now that Werner Herzog is sort of a character in and of himself to all of us, I think that's part of it too. But there was so much humor inherent in this movie that I didn't really notice the first time around.
Yeah, that was the thing that resonated with me too this time, is just how so poorly suited these people are, literally suited for this situation, that the film really just almost is just a nudge away from being just an outright comedy. And I don't think I necessarily found the film funny in terms of I didn't laugh, but it is a situation where they're so out of water, and just the sight of them dragging, you know, what are those things called that natives are carrying, what,
people in carriages,
sedan chair, right, exactly, and through heavy mud, and it's just, and everyone's got the armor on, and you know, and then you can tell, you know, just by the texture of the film, just how hot and awful this situation is. And it's just, you know, there's to an extent Herzog is kind of laughing a little bit behind the camera.
I feel like the humor is something you probably just can't get on the first viewing because it's so dread soaked. You know, so much of the film is about anticipation. We know it's going to go wrong. You know, these people are very clearly on a one-way trip into oblivion. It's, you know, it's the basically the Apocalypse Now trip. We know that they're heading towards a city that doesn't exist.
Yeah,
you know,
well, that's different than Apocalypse Now. At least then we know there's
actually a goal in
right,
mind.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just this, you know, this sticky, horrible, heavy, like dread soaked feeling, and the score really contributes to that. You don't know what's going to happen. So I feel like the first watch through is all about anticipation and tension and sort of fear for these people who are not very sympathetic people. You just don't know how bad it's going to get. And then when you come back to it, you can kind of see that, you know, Herzog is kind of making fun of their hubris. You know, mm-hmm. he is kind of saying, these people are out of their element because they walked into it, and possibly they deserve it.
Right. That's what I mean. I wasn't laughing like, oh,
no,
what
sure.
What a ripper on good time. No. But like, you know, just sort of feeling Herzog's sort of contempt for these people was amusing to me.
Yeah.
Well, there's a black comedy of how badly things go from the start. I mean, it's sort of the whole expedition is kind of made out of desperation to begin with. And then things fall apart very quickly, from the mutiny to the declaration of an emperor. I mean, it is, you know, and I was wondering at what point insanity set in. I guess this thing. We can.
I mean, I'll just spoil it by saying that my topic for the second segment is madness, and I think we can probably get into it there. But I'm right with you. I think one of the biggest questions in the film involves madness and when it sets in.
Well, one thing I did want to talk about, you know, because I often talk about how things that happen outside the frame are not germane to any discussion of what happens within them.
Extratextuals, you call them.
Yes, exactly. But I think it's fair to say that the production history of Aguirre and the Revenant, which we'll get into later, that plays a part in what is there on the screen. So how would you describe, I guess, the impact that this difficult shoot had on the finished product?
Well, I mean, one thing that I think is really relevant is they're actually doing a lot of these things. You know, they actually had natives build them rafts, and they mm-hmm. actually did like sail down these ridiculous rapids. And when you see the raft like going up and down and being almost submerged in this like brown, murky, violent water, like you're actually seeing a raft that people are standing on. When you see them shove the horse off the side of the raft, I mean, they had no special effects.
No, I felt so bad for the horse.
Me too.
Oh, I know. It gets its leg caught on the way down, and it just stumbles. I mean, when I rewatch the film now, I can sort of see the comic elements of what happens to the men, but I always feel like that horse is going to fall and break its leg. Like, this is going to be the viewing on which that horse like snaps a leg and dies.
Oh, and it's the dangers there. I don't think the Humane Society was on board. I mean, that's one thing, actually, as a side issue. Boonwell famously did that for Land Without Bread. Like, would he push a sheep or a goat or something off a cliff? This film that I really love called Satan Tango. There's a cat that gets tortured a little bit, but in any case,
just a little bit.
I mean, this one actually starts with there's a crate full of chickens that they just kind of toss over a cliff to kind of show the precariousness of their situation coming down these very steep stone stairs. And you can't see that box of chickens tumbling down the cliff and smashing over and over without thinking what the same thing would do to a man in armor.
Yeah. I mean, you wonder also about it, about where that puts Herzog morally speaking, because I mean, I think there's an element of sympathy in this film for the natives who are both trying to escort them on this journey and who are in these villages being attacked for no reason without provocation. But at the same time, I mean, for the production of this film, he's notoriously for the production of Fitzcarraldo, he's using native help in probably a fairly dubious way.
But he let the monkeys free.
That's true. The monkeys are unbelievable.
Did you guys read the Wikipedia page on the film?
Oh, yeah.
That whole story about the monkeys and
amazing.
How he had to scam his way into getting those monkeys?
Yeah.
Did you read that?
No. What's the story?
He requested some trappers to get him a ton of monkeys for this final scene. And he, like, they caught him 400 monkeys and he paid them half up front. So then they thought, let's get some extra money out of this. So they took that money and then they went and sold the monkeys to somebody in like Miami or somewhere in America, and they were actually, I believe, at the airport they were going to be shipped off like out of the country, and he found out about it. So Herzog went to the airport, convinced these guys, who I guess they'd never met him or talked to him, I don't know, but he convinced them he was a veterinarian and he needed to take the monkeys and give them vaccinations before they could be shipped to the U.S. and then he loaded them up on his jeep and drove them away into the jungle. And then he shot his scenes, and then he just let him go in the jungle.
Wow.
Wow. All right. I feel like we kind of lost.
The question basically is how the production itself sort of made an imprint on the finished product.
It's queasy to see, and it's queasy making to see that and know, there were no special effects and Herzog seems like a nice enough guy, but I'm not sure that it was the best possible shooting conditions for everyone or that the indigenous people were not, what we would call, I think the word is exploited, in a film about exploitation of indigenous people to some degree.
I was a prince in this land and my people had to look to the ground and no one was allowed to look into my eyes. My people are in chains, just like me, and I must look to the ground. All of us have been made weaker. I cannot fight you, fight with yourselves. I'm very sorry for you, because there is no way out. And I'll never return to my home.
It's all rolled up in an uncomfortable ball there, isn't it?
It is, though it has, I think, one of the aspects of it I like is that it has a sense of spontaneity to it. You know, as I was saying in the opening about ecstatic truth, I mean, that's kind of a principle that he put a name to recently, but that he sort of carried throughout his career. I mean, he's somebody who makes fiction films, makes documentaries, and then kind of mixes the two up. There are elements of fiction as documentaries, then there are elements of obvious ethnographic truth in his fiction films. And I think you can see that just so powerfully in the location shooting of this film and just the feeling that anything can happen. The film doesn't feel that mapped out. Even the scripting of it is choppy. It's a choppy film, and I don't mean that to insult him necessarily, but it is not a smooth ride, narratively speaking. And I think he's kind of giving up a little bit of that to see what he can capture in the moment. And even the camera work is very, I guess it's handheld, as you would describe it, or it's certainly not archly composed in any way.
Right. I mean, Herzog, for all the striking images that are in his films, he's not someone who lays out 8 yards of tracking for elaborate tracking shots where everyone has hit their marks. It's a little more spontaneous than that.
No, but he, I mean, he also thinks things through, as we talked about those framing shots. You know, I mean, those are clearly very thought through and are critical to the film. But I think once you get in the middle of it, it seems like a lot of it is being done on the fly in a very kind of productive way.
There's also, like, the final shot, if I remember correctly, of the film is very clearly was shot from a boat and is, like, just this very smooth, like, panning circular shot kind of taking in all of the action. And that is one of the first times in the movie that really feels planned on a fundamental level in terms of where the camera is going to be and what it's going to be doing. Not just we'll put it on the raft and capture what it's like to go to through the rapids. We'll put it up here and capture the perspective of like looking down over this incredible cliff. But we need to actually capture all sides of this angle, and we need to communicate something through camera movement. We're going to have to actually plan this out. One thing we haven't touched on as far as what went on during the production and how it affected the film, though, is Herzog's famous relationship with Kinski himself, mm-hmm. which, like, this film was really heavily covered in the documentary My Best Fiend in terms of Herzog's clashes with Kinski. There's a not very apocryphal story about the natives asking Herzog if they wanted them to kill Kinski for him because they thought he was a demon. My Best Fiend is a terrific movie after you've watched a few Herzog-Kinski movies. If I remember correctly, the shooting of Aguirre is where we get that famous Herzog quote about how the jungle is a symphony of murder.
That's Fitzcarraldo.
Is it Fitzcarraldo? Mm-hmm.
That's in Burden of Dreams.
Okay, fair enough. Then I am completely wrong.
But it applies, though.
Oh, it applies to everything he does. But from everything I've read, just the prepping of Kinski, Kinski wanted to do the role as like a screaming madman, and Herzog wanted him to be like this whispering madman. So he would wind him up and like get him screaming and ranting, and then shoot once he'd exhausted himself. And I think you can feel that exhaustion on the screen. You can just the way he glowers throughout the entire movie. And I feel like he's glowering at Herzog as much as he's glowering at like the world and his madness.
Well, that's one of the funny. I thought that was one of the funnier scenes where the native is playing the flute and he's just sort of glaring at him murderously the entire time. That made me actually laugh out loud. But so I sort of fell into a bit of a Kinski rabbit hole, and I didn't know all this stuff about him. Like his daughters accused him of sexual harassment when he was growing up, and they've like totally just distanced themselves from him. And all. So at first I was like, oh, he's this comical like crazy guy who pulled out a gun on Herzog and blah blah blah, and they have this crazy relationship. But there's all this really dark stuff out there about him too, which I think is really interesting. And another thing that I found sort of fascinating was the way that Herzog plays with the myth of Kinski. Like, he'll talk about it, and then I read this interview with Fandor from a year ago where he was like, he's a difficult man, he raved like a lunatic, I threatened his life, and then he's like, but that shouldn't interest you, only that what you see on screen should interest you.
Yes, Scott feels so vindicated.
I did it.
Right? Like, I was Herzog. Like, but why have you been talking about this for 30 years then, you know?
Well, I mean, he made a documentary about it,
right,
so, you know,
right.
he can't be too, like, convinced that you should only care about what's
well, that's
screen.
But that's the time to talk about it.
Right.
Not when you're talking about it in relation to any of the films they've collaborated on, right?
That just reads to me as someone who's tired of talking about it, though.
Maybe.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Like, decades later.
What do you make of his performance? Because it doesn't really... It's not naturalistic, exactly, and it doesn't... It feels disconnected from the other performances, but in a way that is not against the film's goals, exactly. You know, he's supposed to stand out, right? I mean, he's a tyrant. He takes control of things, so it makes sense a little bit that he seems alien and crazy and not communicative, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he's... You know, he's a madman, and the out of step performance in the best possible way is exactly what that part needed. I can't imagine anyone else playing that role.
Yeah, for me, there's a degree to which, like, I've seen Kinski in all of these in, you know, other Herzog films, but like in Fitzcarraldo especially, like, he feels to me sometimes like a monkey in a suit. There's a feeling that he's trying to play this character who believes in civilization and the civilized world. And for me, it doesn't always quite fit. Like the crazy things that he does in that movie are like his true self leaking out. Here, this feels like the most Kinski role. You know, just the level of madness and the level of like burning hatred that comes out at all times feels so much more like Kinski, at least as Herzog portrayed him, than any other role that he's had.
I'm the great traitor. There must be no other. Anyone who even thinks about deserting this mission will be cut up into 98 pieces. Those pieces will be stamped on until what is left can be used only to paint walls. Whoever takes one grain of corn or one drop of water more than his ration will be locked up for 155 years. If I, Aguirre, want the birds to drop dead from the trees, then the birds will drop dead from the trees.
And did you ever get the impression that does he really care about the goal? Really? I mean, he cares about pressing on, but I wonder if the thought of the dream that they're really following, if that's ever in his head, because it doesn't seem that way to me watching that performance or hearing the words he says. He's focused on being powerful, on godlike, but not necessarily about what they're actually trying to accomplish.
I mean, he's an iconoclast. Like, he doesn't, it seems to me like he wouldn't actually be content to just make a lot of money and go home and buy a house with all of his money.
Right.
Like, his first action once he takes over is like, let's write a letter to the king and tell him that we, you know, depose him spiritually and that he should, you know, go jump into the sea. Like, the histrionicness of that letter, like the overwhelming arrogance of that letter is way beyond we're going to go look for some money.
Yeah, I mean, and also talking of arrogance, to shift it a little bit, we haven't talked about the religious mission of this trip as well.
Man.
which feels almost Cheney-esque or something, to kind of just go and conquer and then expect everyone to be on board with, well, in this case, Christianity. I'm not sure what the
say Cheney-esque, do you mean because we shoot him in the face?
Yeah, that's true. We shoot what?
Works on many levels.
Oh, right. Shoot the missionary.
It's not a flattering picture of religion in this movie. No. I have one that sort of when they fail to convert the natives instantly, they kill them. There's also that really damning scene where Inez, where the priest tells her, you know, traditionally, the church has been on the side of the powerful, you know, for God's sake. You know, it's basically, I'm going to sell you out to this madman because he's the one with the gun. You know, it's really something.
Well, I think it's interesting that no one in this movie is really good or right. I mean, I'll talk about this a little more in the second segment, but that doesn't seem really to be, outside of Inez and maybe Ursula, though that's kind of ambiguous as well. It seems like they're all sort of making stupid choices based on the need for power, I think. You know, even the slave talks about how when he was a prince, he wouldn't let his people look upon him. And even the priest is shady and greedy and obsessed with power. And, you know, everybody's sort of corrupted by power and greed in this movie. I think that was really interesting to me, too. There's no like good guy, really.
Well, it kind of punctures the myth, too, of explorers as being heroic, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I think the ones who do make discoveries often do so through, you know, a lot of really terrible actions. So the film really kind of lays into that idea.
They're also just, you know, they're really disorganized not just in the sense that the expedition is so badly run, but almost in an emotional way. Like, for me, it all comes down to that scene when the two natives approach them and everybody notices that the male is the husband, I guess, is wearing a little gold necklace, and they rip it off his neck and are like, where did you get this? Where's the gold from? And he points and he's like, he says something in his language that seems to be, oh, it's right over there. There's a huge pile of it. And they're like, shut up, take a Bible, die. Like, it's like they have no idea what they want from him. It's like they have no idea what they want from the country. And they just kind of try to shove like all of their violent impulses and like all of their frustrations at him at once. And then they immediately murder him for not knowing what to do with them. And it's like, that moment could have been whatever it is he's pointing to. Maybe he's certainly not pointing to El Dorado, but maybe he's pointing to a gold mine or a city that does have gold in it. You know, maybe he's pointing to the gold traders. We'll never know because they can't hold still long enough to actually parse the answer to the question they asked.
Gold. Ask him where he got that. Ask him where El Dorado is. Where does this gold come from?
Manu say, Pupatay?
Harte, Mutan.
Where did he say?
Mukons, Nuwa.
Has this savage heard of our Savior, Jesus Christ, and of our true mission to save their souls?
And there's also the thing where they're not going to compromise themselves in any way to for this new environment. There's the expectation, even when they're on a raft,
that they're going to have some element, some amount of comfort. And these rafts have little thatch roofs, and as you said, you have the sedan chairs. Sedan chairs, is that what we call them?
You know, sedan chairs.
Sedan chairs. God,
We've all been in one.
They specifically call it a sedan chair, at least in the translation I watched. They say it like, oh, the sedan chair's tipping. Right. Oh, the sedan chair's in the mud.
Right. It's like, well, maybe we shouldn't have one of those.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm going to say something that I'm not sure I've ever said these words in this order before, but... what were women doing in this movie at all? Like, why did they bring on this trip into the unknown, like with a bunch of like angry, ragged men? Why did they bring the leader's mistress? Why is she wearing lace and velvet? Why does Gera insist on bringing his daughter? Like, they don't have the resources to take care of them. There's nothing for the two women to do on this trip. They're caught in the middle of a dangerous situation, both from the environment and from the men around them, and they have nothing to contribute. I really felt like there was maybe something cultural going on there that I wasn't grasping in terms of why anybody thought this was a good idea.
I don't think the idea was they're along to help. I think the idea was, again, they're going to bring their stuff into this territory, and that involves, you know, people of a more elevated stature being treated as such, and maybe this is going to be an easy journey for them to the City of Gold, which they'll occupy, you know, as they're privileged to do. So I think I don't feel like there's any role for them to play other than to carry this European civilization into the Amazon and, you know, set up shop.
Well, he needs his daughter to create the ethnically pure race.
He doesn't get to that till the end, though.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the original reason that she's
No,
alone,
I know. But yeah. I mean, this is sort of my forum topic as well, why they're there. And I kind of feel like it's to throw the men's hubris into even sharper relief. Again, Inez is one of the only characters who talks any sense at all. So I feel like there's a little bit being said there about these men and sort of the woman who speaks up and everyone's like, shh, you're just confused.
Well, and then the other does the penguin thing. And encounters the end of the world, just walks off into oblivion, right?
Yeah.
It's like, well, I'm gone mad, and I'm just going to head off into the jungle, and I'll never be heard from again.
I'm not sure that her odds there are any worse,
right,
though.
Killed by these crazy men, or like maybe to let nature get at me.
I think it's a forfeit. Pretty clearly. I don't think based on her body language that this is some sort of survival tactic on her part.
No, I'm not saying it's survival. I'm just saying it's her way of picking a lesser evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe so.
A statement. Right. You know, I mean, part of you said that the men are all driven by like greed and selfishness, but they're also very much driven by fear. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I think most of them are driven by fear to go along with what's happening. They that scene where they vote for their new emperor that just consists of Aguirre just staring at each one of them until they capitulate, I think is really telling. And I think her decision to walk into the forest is just her saying, I am not going along with your fear. I'm not afraid. Mm-hmm. I'm making a choice for myself.
I agree. Yeah, I think it's a very powerful moment too, mm-hmm, for that character.
You know what maybe you all have some favorite moments. You know what my favorite Herzog moment in this film is when one of the rafts is caught in an eddy. Like, that is like a perfect, because it's not going, they're not going to survive. They are just going to go around and they're going to paddle and paddle and paddle and they're not going to get out of that situation and it's going to end in death. And it's just like a perfect Herzog image to me. These people who are arrogant and stuck and going around in circles
and
doomed. that's kind of a favorite.
I think the perfect Herzog image in this film is the rats on the raft. How they're just carrying on, like nursing their kids, they're nursing their baby rats or whatever, kind of oblivious to the humans and their presence. Like this is going to pass, and the rats and all the other animals are going to be left when all these silly humans have passed through.
Oh, for a second, I thought you were talking about the monkeys, and I'm like, does he not realize they're monkeys? No, it's a mouse.
Oh, it's a mouse. Yeah. It's a big mouse, though.
I believe it's just a South American mouse. Okay. Like it, the coloration
mouse
of
rat.
It threw me. Like, I'm speaking as somebody who bred mice and rats for a long time, in part to feed a snake. But
okay. I wish you hadn't
Let's
said.
Have a podcast
I
about
wish
that.
You hadn't said to feed a snake. I just wanted to see your rat breeding.
I'm mostly happy that I'm being shown up by a mouse and rat expert, and
right.
not
just scholar.
some casual like rat information. Yeah, no, it threw me for a moment. But yeah, that's a really cool interpretation, because I did kind of wonder what that scene was about. Given that everybody's starving at that point, I really kept expecting somebody to just like grab it and eat it.
So what are some of, I guess, the Herzogian themes at play in Agira?
One of the big ones is nature is going to kill you.
Yeah.
And it does not care. You know, he's really big into this message of like nature is this uncaring and violent void that swallows everything that comes into it, like without mercy and generally without noticing. And you certainly see that a lot of that here. But I think more than anything, like all of his films, and it took me a while to realize this, and I was really delighted when I did, all of his films are fundamentally about some kind of human ambition. Maybe mm-hmm. it's crazy outsized human ambition that get people killed. Maybe it's beautiful ambition that leads to people to create something or experiencing something or drive themselves to something that nobody has before. Maybe it's just the ambition to study things and to learn on a level that nobody has before. But what he really loves is just these outside stories of human outsiders, basically, who mm-hmm. go like above and beyond any sort of normal realm of man.
Well, I mean, one distinction I think is worth making, which I think I made in the intro, is that the character's approach to nature counts. You know, I mean, nature isn't necessarily going to destroy you if you approach it with humility and with rationality and with kind of a clear idea of what it is, you know, and this is the opposite of that. I mean, these are characters who are conquerors. They have no respect for the land, for the people, for the situation that they're in, and they pay the consequences for that. Because nature is nature, and it's gonna do what it's gonna do. And if you don't respect it, if you feel like you have the upper hand, and you approach it with arrogance, then that's when you get into trouble. You know, somebody like Timothy Treadwell. And Grizzly Man is a little bit more kind of both, a little of both. I mean, somebody who is fatally naive, but at the same time is able to function in the wild in a way that does have a certain amount of respect for nature that none of the characters in this film share. With that trenchant, insightful point, I think we're done with the first half of this segment. And before closing out the first half of this week's show, we wanted to hear from you, our listeners. So what's our first email?
Well, we got a lot of good feedback for our Toy Story Good Dinosaur episode, so I'd like to start with an email we got from John Hagen. John writes, "To me, Toy Story is a movie about growing up, both for the human characters in the movie as well as the toy characters. The mother is learning how to live without her husband, the kids are learning how to live in the world as teens and eventual adults, and the toys are learning how to become independent and self-actualized. As someone who also saw this as a preteen, the reason I cried at the end of Toy Story 3 was because, at that moment, the toys had lost their parent figure. To me, this was a symbol for how, at some point in our lives, we must sacrifice the only family we've ever known to become a part of another family. We know the toys will never forget Andy, but they also know that it's now their responsibility to be there for someone who needs them more than Andy possibly could. It's a story of growing up, of how our lives change and how we never stop being ourselves, but at times we have to stop being the person that we once were." It's a nice letter, isn't it, Tasha?
Oh, yeah. That's both sweet and appropriate. But it's also a little melancholy. Here's another email that takes maybe a more, I don't want to say positive, but like a more upbeat approach from Jonathan Franco, who says, "Scott mentioned a few times that Toy Story is refreshing among Pixar's filmography because it has honest-to-goodness jokes and because its overlying emotion is joy rather than sadness. And it's for that same reason that Toy Story remains my favorite Pixar movie. Toy Story is an ode to the carefree wonders of childhood imagination, and so it's appropriate that the movie itself feels like a breezy, small-town, funny, fun adventure. It's a movie that Andy, and maybe even Sid, would watch as a kid and think, that was awesome, rather than saying, will the tears ever stop? To me, Toy Story speaks just as eloquently as its sequels do about that fleeting sense of childhood innocence and simplicity. Woody's speech about how much more a toy matters to a child than any real spaceman ever could sums up the central theme of the entire franchise. But unlike the sequels, Toy Story gets this message across while practicing what it preaches, by maintaining the feeling of a lighthearted romp for the entire movie. People often count its lightheartedness against Toy Story, at least when they're comparing it to other Pixar films, but I think it's what makes it special. I don't mean to knock Pixar's more weepy movies, many of which are some of the best movies of the past two decades, but rather the tendency some people seem to have to measure a Pixar movie's value by its weight in tears. Cars and Monsters University suffer a similar undervaluing, and I suspect for the same reasons. Personally, I find it a joy when Pixar is able to take it easy and tell a simpler story without sacrificing any of the emotional complexity that is its hallmark. I find that really interesting, personally, just because so much of the reaction to The Good Dinosaur in particular has been about, like, its lack of emotional complexity and the fact that it is a simpler story. So I kind of wonder what Jonathan thinks about that. But that's a really interesting letter, and it stands in really strong contrast to Keith's.
Okay, great. We appreciate all your feedback, and would love to hear more from you about this and future episodes. To share your thoughts about Aguirre, the Wrath of God, The Revenant, or both, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode. That wraps up this episode of The Next Picture Show. On the second half of this week's conversation, which drops Thursday, we'll launch our forum talking over the many ways Aguirre, the Wrath of God, and The Revenant relate, and don't, and possibly get into a fight over who is and isn't a pretentious fraud. It'll be out in a few days, and you'll get to hear this.
Stop getting Birdman all over my Revenant.
So look for that later in the week, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at Next Picture Pod, so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, remember, if I want the birds to drop dead from the trees, the birds will drop dead from the trees. I am the wrath of God.